The second case of oral argument this morning is Jason Boyles, appellant versus Douglas Weber, appellee. For the appellant, Mr. Bruce Ellison, an attorney from Rapid City, and for the appellee, Ms. Sherry Sundewald, an assistant attorney general. Mr. Ellison, you may proceed, sir.
May it please the court, counsel?
Excuse me 1 minute, Mr. Ellison.
Yes.
Reset the clock. The court should note for the record that Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, a former justice of this court, to sit in his place. And you can commence again. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel? This is an appeal of a denial of an application for writ of habeas corpus in an effort to get a new trial for Jason Boyles. Mr. Boyles was convicted of second-degree murder in the vehicular homicide, the killing of a pedestrian by a vehicle. This court affirmed in State versus Boyles on direct appeal that conviction. The only issue that was raised on appeal was juror confusion regarding instructions, and therefore we would submit that other issues which counsel failed to raise on appeal, which would be appropriate for consideration by this court, are not barred by res judicata. When Mr. Boyles applied for the writ of habeas corpus, he asserted three bases. One was actual innocence, and we would submit that he is indeed innocent of the offense of conviction. Secondly, he raised ineffective assistance of counsel at both the trial and the appellate stages, and we would submit that the record supports that counsel's performance was deficient and prejudicial. Trial counsel, to his credit, to the reality of the facts and circumstances of this case, and to our profession and our justice system, acknowledged most of the errors that we are raising as requiring a new trial on this particular matter. We would submit that this is a case in which represents that even our best sometimes make mistakes which are prejudicial to a fair trial of the accused. Defendant also asserted newly discovered evidence. There were six eyewitnesses to the state's key witness, Harvey Lynn Sharpute, driving the vehicle and not the defendant, and seven additional witnesses who overheard Harvey Lynn Sharpute admit that she, in fact, was the driver and killer of Mr. Stranger Horse back in 1995. Counsel's prejudicial errors, together with the new evidence, deprive petitioner of a fair trial whose results can be reliable. And I would submit that 20 minutes is hardly time to really address most of these issues.
One question, counsel.
Yes, sir.
You say your client's claiming outright innocence, but you're still seeking relief of a new trial, right?
If this court had the authority, and I'm quite frankly not sure that it does, but I would certainly urge that the conviction simply be vacated. However, I understand that the authority may be limited in this instance to granting a new trial, and we would certainly ask for a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. On August 10th of 1995, the petitioner, Ms. Sharpute, and a few others from the White River area community spent a night of drinking. They were driving around the community in the defendant's or the petitioner's car, father's car, excuse me. They were in the town of White River along the River of White River, Horse Creek, and Swift Bear communities. The drinking evening ended approximately 6:30 a.m. with the striking and killing of a pedestrian, Ronald Stranger Horse, who was walking along Highway 83 just south of White River. The issue at trial, and we would submit the issue before this court, was essentially who was driving the Boyles vehicle at the time of the homicide. There were two witnesses at trial to this particular moment, and that was Harvey Lynn Sharpute and Jason Boyles. The state's key witness, Ms. Sharpute, admitted on the stand that she generally was a liar and that had lied to investigators in this particular case. The state's case included two witnesses who saw Mr. Boyles driving his father's vehicle before the incident. Harvey Lynn Sharpute testified that Mr. Boyles was in fact driving the vehicle when it struck Mr. Stranger Horse at a high rate of speed, and that Mr. Boyles said shortly before this striking, "Watch this," and then swerved the car into Mr. Stranger Horse. After the homicide, a witness in the Swift Bear community, Ms. Gloria Moran, saw Harvey Lynn Sharpute exit the passenger side of the vehicle and then watch the Boyles vehicle drive away. When Ms. Moran and Ms. Sharpute spoke, after Ms. Moran pointed out to Ms. Moran that Ms. Moran saw some extremely fine particles of glass on her forehead and her legs. A short time later, an ASCS employee by the name of David Stefan saw Mr. Boyle standing by the damaged car outside the White River ASCS office. One of the things that Mr. Stefan noticed was a large, obvious glass cut on Mr. Boyle's left forearm. An FBI agent by the name of Drew McConaughey interviewed Ms. Sharpute a couple of hours later for about 40 minutes. He did not see any glass on her. Mr. Boyles had no conscious memory of the events due to what Dr. Streicher, a court-appointed psychologist from the University of South Dakota, concluded was both an alcohol blackout and trauma amnesia. He had been appointed by the court as a forensic hypnotist to do a forensic memory recall session with Mr. Boyles, which turned out to be successful, and it was in fact fully videotaped. According to that hypnosis session, Mr. Boyles left the Swift Bear community driving on Highway 83, pulled over to the side of the road to urinate because of the amount of beer that he had been drinking, got out of the vehicle, did so, and when he did so, Ms. Sharpute moved into the driver's seat and refused to leave. He got in the passenger seat and they drove off at a high rate of speed, and that Ms. Sharpute said, "Watch this," before she struck and killed Mr. Stranger Horse. At the time of the striking of the victim in this particular case, Mr. Boyle's left arm was resting on the console of the seat while he sat in the passenger seat, and we believe that's how he got the cut on this particular matter. After the striking of Mr. Stranger Horse, the vehicle pulled over. Ms. Sharpute insisted that Mr. Boyles drive, which he then did, then being seen by Ms. Moran. Harvelyn Sharpute denied driving that vehicle at any time that morning. Thus, of critical importance to the defense would have been any witness who saw her driving, particularly during that period of time in the early morning hours, approximately 6:30 in the morning. No witnesses were presented at the trial who saw Ms. Sharpute driving the vehicle. That left Mr. Boyle's story through the hypnosis uncorroborated, and it left Ms. Sharpute's story unimpeached. Yet we would submit that the record now shows that six witnesses existed who saw Harvey Lynn Sharpute driving the vehicle at the time of the homicide. The first trial of this matter ended in a hung jury. The second trial of this matter resulted in a conviction for second-degree murder. The principal differences between the first trial and the second trial involve the videotaped forensic hypnosis session and the testimony in the second trial of a glass fracturing expert.
Was the same defense attorney in both first and second trial?
I'm sorry, sir, I couldn't hear.
Was the same defense attorney representing your client in the first and second trial?
He was.
All right.
When did these witnesses surface?
They began to surface a few years after the conviction, and they proceeded to over the years. This is a very small community. Most people know everybody that was involved in terms of Ms. Sharpute and Mr. Boyles.
How long was the conviction after the incident?
I'm sorry, sir?
How long was the conviction after the incident?
Approximately, I believe the first trial was approximately 7 or 8 months after the incident, and the second trial was 2 months after that, 2 or 3 months after that.
So they're about 3 years away when they start to, 3 years from the incident itself, from the death, when
yes.
they start to reappear.
Well, yes, sir. And what I would submit, though, is it's not so much that these witnesses came forward. What happened was that some people told somebody right away, some people told some people after a period of time, and eventually word started filtering over to the family that someone might have information. When I was appointed then, we began to try and find these people, independently interviewed them, and obtained the documentation that we filed with our application. At the first trial, the trial court admitted the entire videotaped hypnotic session. The trial court ruled that Dr. Streicherch was as expert as a person can be on hypnosis, that the session was as reliable as the process gets, that the evidence was more probative than prejudicial, and this was the only eyewitness testimony presented on behalf of the defense. It permitted the jurors to view Mr. Boyle's demeanor as well as the details of his story in evaluating the evidence. And as I mentioned earlier, this resulted in a hung jury. In the second trial, the trial court denied the admission of the videotape. The court only permitted Dr. Streisert to testify. And Dr. Streisert was not allowed to read from the transcript, and it was a 51-page transcript, single space, of this hypnotic memory recall session. His memory was less than clear, and I would submit that the record clearly shows that he just didn't recall a lot of the details. It came in very disjointed. And trial counsel acknowledged at the habeas hearing that, in fact, it came in a summarized and disjointed fashion. So the impact of being able to present a defense on Mr. Boyles was, we feel, highly prejudicial by the trial court's failure to include the videotape in this particular matter. The trial court, in excluding this videotape, relied upon the civil case of Somerville versus Grevelos, an opinion of this court, which was a negligence action. Trial court said, well, look, the problem is that when people see something on TV, they believe that it's real. The Somerville case had to do with a situation where a videotape, it was a negligence action, and a videotape was made of the plaintiff's actions and was designed to show the scene of the accident and injuries. And the Supreme Court affirmed the refusal to allow this tape to be admitted into evidence because, first of all, it was demonstrative and it was not substantially in compliance with the facts of the case. That's contrary to what we have here. In addition, this is a case involving exculpatory evidence. And in addition, it's the only evidence, and it's clearly the best evidence, and I would get to that in a moment. This court in State versus Adams generally approved the admissibility or the reliability of hypnotic memory recall sessions. And this court in Adams adopted the Sprisonetic versus General Motors Corporation, Little versus Armatrout, and State versus Kurd standards as to the procedures that must be followed before the evidence of such a session is admissible in court. In Adams, the court recognized that hypnosis is an accepted medical tool for memory recall. And this is a case of first impression for this court. In probably a number of ways around this issue. Essentially, what the Adams Court held was that hypnotically enhanced recollection is admissible if the procedural safeguards are rigidly adhered to, and that would include videotaping. And here, all of the procedures were, in fact, rigidly adhered to. We would submit that this videotape should have been admitted under SDCL 19-1635 as an exception to the hearsay rule. Dr. Streisert in this particular matter was subject to cross-examination, which is one of the criteria, and we would submit that Mr. Boyles was unavailable to testify since he had no memory following the hypnosis session of the events that occurred in and around the time of the homicide. And that was, in fact, a finding of this court on direct appeal. However, the videotape and its admissibility were not issues before this court at that time. The videotape was offered on an issue of material fact and was clearly relevant as to who was driving. The trial court ruled that it would assist the jury in determining who was driving the vehicle which struck and killed Mr. Strangerhorse. So essentially, we're talking about what should be admitted, simply the testimony of Dr. Streisert in its disjointed fashion, or the videotape allowing the jury to actually watch the demeanor and listen to the specific words of Mr. Boyles.
The trial court's rationale was that it found the Somerville case after the first trial, and that's why it was, in essence, reversing itself?
Yes.
Okay.
Help me understand another thing, if you might, Mr. Ellison.
Please, sir.
As I understand it, under habeas corpus, this court's inquiry is limited to jurisdictional and constitutional issues. Could you help me understand how this particular issue gets to the constitutional provision?
It goes to the
violation.
Heart. Yes, sir. It goes to the heart of whether Mr. Boyles had a fair trial.
Okay, and please explain that to me.
If the only evidence that Mr. Boyles was able to present on his behalf that he was not the driver and that the state's key witness was the driver came through this video, and the video was not permitted, and instead someone was able to try and do as best they could, but in an clearly far from good manner present what Mr. Boyle said. It deprived the jury of the ability to actually watch Mr. Boyle's demeanor when he was giving the story, same thing that jurors would do in any witness. It denied him, therefore, the right to present a defense in a manner in which he would be entitled to. And this was clearly exculpatory evidence, and it was really the only evidence he had. And we would submit that it was the best evidence, and we would submit that if one goes to 1918-1 through 4, dealing with the admissibility of photographs, of which videotapes clearly are, and 1918-4 clearly talks about that if one wants to present evidence of a photograph other than the original, it's only under circumstances where it's been lost or destroyed or unavailable. And we cited a case for the court, Smith versus State, which was an Arkansas case, in which the appellate court in Arkansas reversed a conviction of a man where the trial court denied admissibility of a videotape interview of an exculpatory witness who suddenly developed a memory lapse when it came time for trial. The transcript was admitted, unlike in the instant case, but the court said that only the video permitted jurors the opportunity to determine firsthand the demeanor of the witness and allow the jury to test its credibility while making, in that case, a confession. And so we would submit that under our rules of evidence, that this videotape should have been admitted, and that it was prejudicial error for counsel not to have appealed this issue, because we believe that under the unique facts of this particular case, this videotape should have been allowed. And we feel, therefore, that the habeas court was clearly erroneous and made errors as a matter of law. The second principal difference, and I'm going to run out of time long before I get a chance, had to do with a glass fracturing expert that was presented by the state. The state's expert talked about how the particles, Mr. Stranger Horse hit the car, hit the windshield fractured, and the glass went into the car. He said that larger pieces of glass would be on the passenger, very fine pieces would be on the driver, just from the angle of this particular matter. That was about all that he said. Trial counsel got this report a few days before trial and didn't use it at all during the course of his cross-examination. That report said some very, very important things. One of the things said was that the passenger would definitely suffer cuts, and at least some of them would be severe. Mr. Boyle's had a severe cut on his left forearm. Ms. Sharpute, who we would submit was the driver, only had very fine particles of glass on her, and she had no cuts. So if the report had been used by trial counsel, this expert, an FBI agent, Mr. Raywald, could have been turned into a highly exculpatory defense witness. And we feel that it would have clearly undermined the confidence, or should at this point clearly undermine the confidence of any verdict in this particular matter. Trial counsel admitted that this was not a trial tactic. In fact, he said at the habeas hearing, it should have been asked. In addition, trial counsel during the course of the trial gave a hypothetical to the expert. He said, well, what if a person raised their arm up in front of them? Would that allow for their arm to be cut from this impact? And of course, the expert said yes. However, that hypothetical was not based upon the facts of Mr. Boyle's in the hypnotic recall session. He said his arm was resting on the counsel between the two seats. So the jury really didn't have any evidence at all from this very important witness for the defense, because I don't know that he had all that much for the prosecution. And we would submit that the habeas court erred as in its factual findings that this led to effective assistance of counsel. In the minute and three quarters I have left, I want to briefly touch a little bit on what we call newly discovered witnesses. They fit into two categories. The first, those who saw Harvey Lynn Sharpute driving the car at the time of this particular, or around the time of this particular incident, would be both impeachment and substantive witnesses. And then the second grouping would be as to the confessions of Ms. Sharpute that, in fact, she was the driver. There was a report sitting in the prosecution's files of a White River officer by the name of Joe Krogman. Mr. Krogman had interviewed a person by the name of Tony Valandra. Tony Valandra said that in the early morning hours, he saw the Boyles vehicle three different times. The last time he saw it on Highway 83 and saw a girl driving. Now, trial counsel was aware of a witness by the name of Dawn Andrews, in fact, testified at a pretrial motion hearing. And Ms. Andrews said similarly that she had seen but identified Harvey Lynn Sharpe as getting out of the vehicle in White River right around 6:30 in the morning. And trial counsel said he made a decision not to use that witness because standing alone, he really questioned her credibility. He wondered whether she would really add anything. However, upon being confronted at the habeas hearing with Mr. Valandra's interview in Officer Krogman's report, he said it would have made a difference to him and he would have in fact used both of them as witnesses. In addition, you know, we had four witnesses who were subpoenaed but didn't even show up for the hearing. And we asked for a continuance, and they were further witnesses of Harvey Lynn Sharpe driving, further witnesses to whom Harvey Lynn Sharpe had made admissions.
Your time has expired, Mr. Ellison.
It has, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Sundemall, you have 20 minutes.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sherry Sundemwald. I'm an Assistant Attorney General for the state, and I represent the state in this matter. As counsel has already indicated, petitioner filed an application for writ of habeas corpus in 2002. He was convicted, I believe, in August of 1996 on second-degree murder. Judge Wilbur held an evidentiary hearing where petitioner called 10 witnesses. He also sought to introduce affidavits and declarations from other witnesses who were not available on the day of the hearing. The essence of the witnesses' testimony you could divide into two parts. Some witnesses claiming that on the night before Ronald Stranger Horse was killed, they saw Harvey Lynn Sharpe driving petitioner's car. None of them testified to seeing her driving at the time Ronald Stranger Horse was killed. I think there were six additional witnesses who claimed to have heard Harvey Lynn Sharpe at some point in time make claims that she was actually the driver. I believe the record would indicate one of those witnesses, Margaret Hopkins, allegedly heard Sharpe make those statements actually before the trial. And in reference to a question I think Justice Sabers posed, Ronald Stranger Horse was killed in August of 1995, and it was June of 96 when the second trial, the jury found petitioner guilty. Based upon the evidence presented, the habeas court denied petitioner's claims, finding that the witnesses the petitioner presented were not credible. Many of them were close friends to either petitioner or his family or relatives. Many of these witnesses, not all of them, I'm categorizing here, I recognize that. It's not going to apply to every one of them, each of these statements, but many of them had been prosecuted by the state, had personal dislikes for the prosecutor. There were witnesses who claimed that they came forward later after the fact because they didn't want to get involved at the time of trial. The court found that these things all rendered these witnesses that were presented to be not credible, much like this Dawn Andrews who had testified in the first trial, and the defense counsel had decided he wasn't going to call her the second time because he said her credibility hurt the case more than helped it. The habeas court also found that the defense lawyer was a very capable and experienced trial attorney who had tried a number of murder cases.
But if Mr. Wrench had called Adams the second time after having discovered the statement from Krogman from Valandra, wouldn't it have been, and he's acknowledged afterwards that it would have been effective and he would have done it. And I think he even admitted that it was ineffective assistance of counsel not to do it. Don't you think that's a major factor?
I don't know that because we didn't have Tony Valandra testify at the habeas hearing. And there's no indication of why he wasn't called. Officer Krogman wasn't called. But there's also things in that report that would indicate that Tony Valandra might not have been as helpful to the petitioner as he would like this court to believe.
Why is that?
Well, the report, as I recall, and unfortunately I don't have a copy of the report, but my recollection of that report is Tony Valandra indicated he saw a girl driving. the car, and he said he saw that car three or four times. There's not time frames on those three or four times he saw that car being driven by petitioner and these other people. He does say around 4 o'clock he saw that car, and I think it was at that point in time he saw the girl driving, but I'm not even certain of that. But I believe that might be what the report indicated. It also indicated that Tony Volandra had indicated that there was something in there about Jason driving crazy. So whether these statements by Tony Volandra are as helpful as the petitioner would like this court to believe is quite frankly an unknown at this point in time. But what is known is there's nothing in the record to indicate that they attempted to call this Mr. Volandra to the stand or this Officer Krovman.
So you're saying they've not established prejudice as a result of not calling Volandra?
Exactly. They certainly haven't established the prejudice. We don't know why he wasn't called. We know that they called a number of witnesses, but those two were not two of the witnesses they called. We also know, or there's indications, that this Mr. Volandra called petitioner's father the morning of the accident. So petitioner's father certainly knew that there's Mr. Volandra out there. That much we do know. Why they decided not to call him, I can't respond to that. There's no indication in the record of that. But he certainly wasn't a witness that testified at the habeas hearing. And so now to come forward and claim that he was the witness that was going to establish petitioner's innocence, I think is a stretch. Particularly since we don't know what he would have testified to, and what we have in the report certainly does not establish petitioner's innocence.
Were the witnesses that the trial court or the habeas court determined to be not credible, did they all testify? Or on what basis did the trial court determine that they were not credible?
Well, I can go through each witness.
Well, and I don't need to have you do that, but could you speak in generalities, please?
And that's what I attempted to do earlier. Many of them had been prosecuted themselves by the
state. I understand. You've said that. But did they testify at the habeas court, or did the court become aware of that through reports from the state? Or what did the judge have in front of, was Judge Wilbur?
Yes.
What was in front of her at the time she made the determination that they were not credible? Was it their own testimony, or testimony from others, or reports, or all of the above?
It was 10 witnesses' testimony. Petitioner called 10 witnesses, 4 of whom who claimed to see Sharp Butte driving at some point during the evening or the early morning hours, 6 of whom said that they had heard Harvey Lynn Sharp Butte at some point in time crying or giggling or whatever in reference to having gotten by with killing Ronald Stranger Horse. Most of those witnesses, interestingly enough, who claimed to have heard Sharp Butte make those statements were drinking at the time they heard those statements being made, allegedly heard those statements being made. And I think just about every one of them also admitted that or claimed that Harvey Lynn Sharp Butte herself was drinking at the time those statements were made. I assume, went into the court's decision that she found none of those witnesses to be credible. And of course, we have the 4 witnesses that I recall that did not appear, had been subpoenaed. 3 of them were in jail, 1 was ill. Counsel himself conceded that testimony was all cumulative to what had been presented with the other 10 witnesses, and they wanted the case to move on. So the court did not, I believe she introduced, or those affidavits were admitted, but she did not continue the hearing for the other 4 witnesses that did not appear the day of the evidentiary hearing to allow them to testify later on. She found that testimony would have been cumulative.
Thank you.
In reference to petition, by my understanding, raised what amounted to ineffective assistance of counsel on 6 different grounds. And the primary argument that I believe petitioner argued about was the hypnotic session, in which petitioner sat down with Dr. Streichert and at that point in time, through the hypnosis session, was able to recall what had happened. I think it's important this court understand petitioner at the time, he testified at trial, but he could not testify to anything that happened when Ronald Stranger Horse was killed. He had absolutely no recollection of any of it. So he was not able to sit down with Dr. Streichert and say, this is what I remember about what happened. Nor was he, after he had his hypnotic session, able to recall any of the events that had occurred. The cases that I've all read in reference to testimony coming in as a result of hypnotic session recall, those witnesses have some memory of what's going to be testified about. Here, our petitioner had no memory at all of what had occurred. What he, in essence, was wanting to do was have this hypnotic session with Dr. Streichertz and make some statements in that hypnotic session and then have Dr. Streichertz, in essence, testify for petitioner. Because he himself, the court found that he was unavailable. He had absolutely no recollection of what had occurred.
Well, wouldn't there be some prejudice to the defendant on the as a result of the failure to appeal the denial by the trial court judge of the hypnotic videotape?
I don't know how there can be prejudice when it's clearly not admissible. Under this court's ruling in Adams, and I think what happened is the trial court, the first trial, did allow that tape in. You're right, petitioner's correct. And I think the trial court, after the first trial, did some research and said, I don't think it should have been admissible. And he based it on that, I don't know how you say the names right, Panatz versus GMC, which is one of the cases this court relied on in Adams. And this court in Adams set forth a six-factor test, if you will, for the admissibility of this kind of testimony.
But his ruling doesn't really make sense. I mean, if you deny the videotape, but then allow the doctor to testify about it, which clearly is not the best evidence, does that make any sense at all?
Well, I think the trial court was being very helpful to the petitioner and allowed him to introduce evidence that wasn't admissible. Because under Adams, it's my understanding, prior to the session, the hypnotist should obtain from the subject a detailed description of the facts as the subject remembers them. The subject didn't remember anything. So Dr. Streichertz came in and testified to things that the petitioner himself could not testify to.
So you're saying there'd be no prejudice because even if he appealed it, he wouldn't have gotten it in, assuming you're right on the ruling.
Exactly. He got more than what he was entitled to under the law, and so therefore I don't know how you can claim there's prejudice to him by the fact it wasn't appealed.
Did they bring out through the doctor the fact that his recollection was is that his left hand was on the console?
Most certainly. Most certainly they did. And so the doctor was able to testify to what petitioner believes happened. So in essence, petitioner was allowed to testify through Dr. Streichertz. And it would be the state's position that that testimony by Dr. Streichertz was not at all admissible under the rules that have been set forth by this court under State v. Adams. And so petitioner was allowed leeway that under the law should not have been given, and so therefore there's certainly no prejudice. The other issue deals with the FBI agent, Mr. Raywalt, Agent Raywalt, who, as I understand the issue, petitioner is arguing, didn't cross-examine the FBI glass expert Raywalt about a cut on petitioner's arm and the absence of glass cuts on Sharp Butte. I would ask this court to look at trial transcript page 782, where defense counsel specifically asked Mr. Agent Raywalt, did he tell you that Jason Boyles had a cut scratch on his arm from the glass that actually had bled? The agent said no. Another question, you apparently knew that Harvey Lynn Sharp Butte had no cuts or scratches that even drew blood as a result of this, of her being a passenger either in the driver's seat or the passenger seat of this car. If you mean freely bled, no. So, in actuality, defense counsel did ask Agent Raywalt in reference to whether petitioner's arm had been cut and whether there was any glass cuts on Sharp Butte. That, as I understand things, was the essence of the ineffective assistance of counsel claim on that particular point. Defense counsel actually did a pretty effective job of cross-examining Agent Raywalt. But what Agent Raywalt was able to testify to was that the passenger would have dramatically more glass particles than the driver. Now, Agent Raywalt never testified as to who was sitting where in that vehicle. What he testified to was the physical evidence. And he also testified that it didn't mean that the driver would be free of a cut. I think it's also important to note that it's not really clear where that cut was on petitioner's body. Stefan is the gentleman who said, I saw him and he had a cut on his arm. And I don't think that cut is quite as severe as perhaps petitioner would make it out to be to this court. I'll leave that to the court to review that testimony. He had a difficult time describing it. He said it wasn't a cut, it was more like a scratch. And it was about a half inch. And at first he says, yeah, I think it's on the left arm. But during cross-examination, he said, I can't be positive it was even on his left arm. So whether he was cut on the left arm or the right arm is really questionable at this point in time. But what Agent Raywalt was able to tell the jury was the person that's sitting in the passenger seat is going to have most of the glass on him. And I think the testimony at trial establishes through Gloria Moran and Agent McConaughey that Harvey Lynn Sharpe was covered with glass. Her skin was irritated, her legs, her arms, her face possibly. It was difficult to tell because of acne issues, her hair, her forehead. Whereas the officer who arrested petitioner patted him down and never noticed any glass. The record, I think, establishes that Harvey Lynn Sharpe was the one occupant in the car who was covered with glass, and according to Agent Raywalt, that would be the person in the passenger seat. And of course, you have Gloria Moran saying she saw her get out of the passenger seat when they drove into Swift there. Granted, Gloria Moran also didn't see Ronald Stranger Horse being run over. The only people that were there were Ronald Stranger Horse, who obviously can't testify to what happened, Harvey Lynn Sharpe, and petitioner. And petitioner doesn't remember. In reference to all the newly discovered evidence, I think the one other point I need to make is I'm still not clear, and I think Justice Miller, you addressed this to an extent, under how this motion for a new trial warrants habeas relief, because petitioner's brief only raises this claim as a statutory claim, in essence. They rely on State versus Gimm, which relied on a statute talking about a motion for a new trial. There's no constitutional violation claim, at least in the briefs. I mean, so whether this is really actually this court has jurisdiction over that claim, I think is that issue. I don't think that they've raised it as a constitutional claim, at least in their brief.
Well, if it's part of ineffective assistance of counsel, that all becomes moot, doesn't it?
Well, but this part of the, there's two issues in petitioner's brief, and the first is failure to deny, or trial court's denial of a motion for a new trial. The second issue is the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, where he raises six different arguments, but
never incorporates that into, well, how does he get to the claim then of failure to appeal?
His failure to appeal was in reference to different issues. Failure to appeal, I think the issue on the prosecutor's use of vouching and leading questions. I'm trying to remember which issues it is he's arguing should have been appealed.
Well, he's arguing that he should have appealed the denial of the admission of the hypnotic videotape.
That's under ineffective assistance of counsel. That's correct.
Yeah.
But the new evidence claim is his first issue, and he never raises that as a constitutional issue. And therefore, it's my argument to this court that he hasn't properly brought that to the court in habeas, under a habeas claim, which this court would have jurisdiction to review. The other ineffective assistance of counsel claims he raised were the failure to investigate the contents of the report by Officer Krogman. I think he also talked about Margaret Hopkins' failure to identify Hopkins, and of course she admitted she didn't come forward to these statements until after the fact, even though she claims to have heard them sometime in 1995, which means that she heard them certainly before petitioner's trial. Just didn't want to get involved, I think is what she said. Boy, and didn't know that there was a trial going on and didn't know who to report it to. The other issues were the improper vouching or bolstering by Agent McConaughey. The improper vouching and the closing argument by counsel, and the prosecutor's use of leading questions. None of those, though all of those issues were raised as ineffective assistance of counsel claims. The motion for a new trial, though, rested on new evidence. And that's my point, Your Honor. Hope I'm making that clear. If the court wants me to go into some of those issues that petitioner did not address in the course of his first 20 minutes, I can certainly do that. Otherwise, I would rely on the briefs and entertain any questions that the court might have.
Any further questions from the bench? If not, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Ellison, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. I want to touch briefly on the Adams case. I believe a fair reading of the Adams case would show that its holding is fairly narrow, at least in terms of the issues that were before it. It had to do with the admissibility of state witnesses, pre-hypnosis evidence, and not the admissibility of an audio tape that followed that particular matter. However, this court took that opportunity in Adams to discuss the standards that would be required to be met before admissibility of hypnotic memory recall evidence. And that's how we have our law today, although it has never been applied before today in a particular case. I want to touch on the witnesses that were found post-trial. The court did state its two reasons. It's that many of the witnesses or their close friends or relatives have been prosecuted by the state, and certainly they held a personal dislike. However, two people were asked during the course of the evidentiary hearing about whether they had problems with the prosecutor. This is of three people of the eight who testified who actually had convictions from prosecutions from the state's attorney. One of them said he had problems with the state's attorney. The other person that was asked, Nola Grill, said she never had any problems with him. She was prosecuted for a misdemeanor. That still left one other person with a felony record who was not asked, five people who had no criminal records, prosecutions from the state's attorney's office, and the habeas court didn't address them at all. The court, other than saying, well, if you've ever, and this is a prosecutor been in this small community for a long time, I would submit there'd hardly be anybody in that community that had not either themselves or someone in their family been prosecuted at one time or another. I've never heard of a rule that makes you carte blanche and credible. And the court did not point to anything in its findings that would say, this indicates this person is incredible. This indicates this person is incredible. Instead, it just said, blanketly, many people have criminal records with this prosecutor, so how can we believe them? It would allow for no person from a small community like Millette County to ever come for a new trial with newly discovered evidence and new witnesses, because this would too much be like the case. And this brings to mind something that I would like to just generally address in this court. I know it doesn't matter what I personally feel in terms of whether this is a travesty or not, but in 29 years of practice, if this case doesn't warrant a new trial, I don't know what does. The only thing that we don't have is a videotape of Harvey Lynn Sharpe driving at the time that she struck and killed Roger Strangerhorse. When witness after witness after witness is now available, many of whom corroborate each other, all of them are generally consistent with their evidence. And if Harvey Lynn Sharpe generally, yes, when she gets drunk, as many people do when they get drunk, they start to talk. And she talks about things that bother her. And she did, and this was overheard by people who've come forward, some of whom didn't even know the defendant. And I want to address some of those questions. For example, Margaret Hopkins. She knew Harvey Lynn Sharpe. She did not know Jason Boyles. She said she didn't come forward because she was scared. The trial record clearly indicates that Harvey Lynn Sharpe, who drinks a lot, gets very violent when she drinks. So in a small community, the fact that she's scared to come forward to reveal what she knows of someone that she does know versus Jason Boyles, who she doesn't know, I would submit is not all that surprising. There was witnesses such as Mia Youngman. She She's staying over at her friend's house, Nola Brills. She stays overnight. She's having problems with her husband. She has to get up to go to work, so she leaves. She starts driving over to her, towards her home. That's where, at about 7 a.m., she said, she had to be at work at 7 a.m., it was just getting light, so we're in the right time period. She sees Harvey Lynn Sharpute driving the vehicle, Jason Boyles in the passenger vehicle. Nola Brill confirms that Mia Youngman stayed with her that particular night. She also has to go to work at about 7 o'clock, and as she's leaving for work, she sees the Boyles car, the windshield is broken, she sees Harvey Lynn Sharpute driving. Kevin Youngman, who is, by the time of the habeas hearing, the estranged husband of Mia Youngman, so those two, as we all know what happens in those situations, they have no reason to support each other. She supports it. He supports it. He sees Harvey Lynn Sharpute driving the vehicle. One of the women that failed to appear but was served, Emma Dean White Buffalo, she was a classmate of Harvey Lynn Sharpute's, and she corroborates the other witnesses. She saw the Boyles vehicle on Highway 83. The driver's door was open. The driver's seat was empty, and Harvey Lynn Sharpute was outside of the vehicle. These also corroborated Andrews and Valandra. So it's not a question that, I mean, now we have six eyewitnesses. So what is enough then? And many of whom don't have criminal records. Many of them have no animosity towards the prosecutor. There's nothing in the record about animosity towards the prosecutor. People generally, you know, we'd like to think that if people come forward when they have knowledge of something going on in the community. And sadly, too often they don't. And I would submit in a small community, especially where you have two families within that community, people don't often want to get involved, especially when they know both parties, as in this particular case. As to witnesses who overheard the admissions of Harvey Lynn Sharpute, I already talked about Margaret Hopkins. Well, Del Murphy is at a party in Rapid City when he hears Sharpute making her comments. Mark Goodshield, who knows both Ms. Sharpute and Mr. Boyles and is not friends with either, said he overhears the admissions. And then we have three additional witnesses, Ms. Inez Duran, John Eagletail, Chad Whitefeather, who did not appear. From the sworn papers that we filed with the application, Inez Duran is married to Harvey Lynn Sharpute's uncle. And she sees Harvey Lynn Sharpute crying and hears her talking about her fear of going to jail, and if I find out they ran over Ronald Stranger Horse. So what more could there be? What more is it possible to find, to present to a habeas court that would undermine the confidence of the verdict? Certainly we would submit 13 witnesses should at least undermine the confidence. Our standard is not in front of the habeas court to show absolute proof of innocence, although we feel we can do that. Our standard is simply, have we undermined the confidence in the verdict? And I would submit that between these newly discovered witnesses and the failure to use the lab report and the findings of Agent Raywald, that any of those would have created a reasonable doubt, and I would submit that Mr. Boyles would not be sitting in prison for the many years now that he has in this particular matter.
Are there any other cases where this court has, on a habeas action, granted a new trial because of newly discovered evidence? Because the cases you cite are actually look like they're direct appeals.
Well, when I cited direct appeals, I tried to cite them for the holdings on the law that we felt the trial court had erred on. This court has not overturned a lot of habeas courts. What I would submit is that does not in any way negate the relief that is cried out for in this particular case. And perhaps this court has not been confronted with an evidentiary record of this magnitude, so warranted a reversal of the habeas court's decision. And as I believe all of the habeas cases talk about, the courts must look at each case individually. And here, as I said, There's nothing else. This is not a DNA case. So there's nothing else that could possibly have been obtained other than a video of Ms. Sharp driving. One issue that was touched on briefly by counsel on the other side in my remaining 50 seconds, the vouching that was done in this particular case, we would submit, was clearly improper. An FBI agent should not be able to talk about while saying, well, I didn't believe the witness the first time, but the second time she told me the story, yeah, I believe that. I think that's what the evidence shows. I didn't see anything to contradict it. This is the kind of vouching that has been condemned clearly by this particular court, and certainly counsel's repeated comments during closing argument, I believe this man is guilty. Not the evidence shows, I believe he is guilty. I want to thank the court for its time. This is a very difficult case. I urge you to please grant relief. It is warranted here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Allison. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.